2. Mom and Dad, a Love Story. Generally, there are two categories of child actors. The first is the trained animal. He is basically given his line readings by an adult and asked to copy them down to the last detail, including facial expressions. It's not really acting, more like performing a trick. If this kid has a crying scene, he is not challenged to reach within and summon real emotion. Instead, someone in the makeup department comes out with a dropper of glycerin and puts some tears on his face. The director instantly gets the results he's after, and everybody's happy. The second category is the child who is allowed to be a child. The director encourages him to behave naturally so he doesn't get stiff or self-conscious. The kid does several takes of the scene, and later on, in post-production, the editors cut away everything but the prime sirloin. Dad devised a third way. He taught Ron and me how to understand a scene in an emotional language we could wrap our brains around. He started out by asking us three fundamental questions. Where do you think your character just was? Why is your character entering the scene? And where would he like to go? We would build a little backstory for the character and then apply it to the material. This process gave my performances an honesty that the trained animal kid could never deliver. Was I entering the room excitedly? Hesitantly? Was I hoping that we would get to eat ice cream for dinner? The viewers were oblivious to these interior monologues, but they benefited from a fuller, richer performance from me. You know who else benefited? The director. He didn't have to settle for Category 1, a cutesy but superficial performance, or for Category 2, trying to catch lightning in a bottle. When Ron was little, Dad was still figuring this stuff out, jerry-rigging that pretend boom mic and feeling his way through the teaching process. By the time I came along, though, Dad had a system. Preparation was the key. He had us so well drilled that we created none of the hassle with which child actors are associated. Fits of temper, trouble reciting lines, incontinence. Ron and I rarely required retakes. No production ever slowed down on account of a Howard brother. Dad was the child whisperer, with an innate grasp of how to motivate a young actor to succeed without applying undue pressure. Mom was the child whisperer's whisperer, bucking up her husband as he weathered the ups and downs of his own show business career. As good as they were in these roles, they did not anticipate playing them. Both my parents graduated from high school dreaming of stardom. They met in a drama class at the University of Oklahoma. Dad, an underclassman still going by his birth name, Harold Beckenhold, had found a mentor figure in a senior theater major named Dennis Weaver, later to become the star of the long-running NBC series MacLeod. One day, in 1947, for a two-person scene study, Dennis decided to pair Harold with another drama student, a young woman named Jean Spiegel. Harold was green and unsophisticated. He grew up enamored of Roy Rogers and Gene Autry movies, but he never saw them in a proper movie house. In Scheidler, Oklahoma, the little town nearest to his family's farm, you sat on your coat and watched a picture as it was projected onto the side of a building. Dad fancied himself the heir to Rogers and Autry, the next singing cowboy star. At one point, he had a plan, and I mean a serious plan, to ride his horse, who was named Lucky, from Oklahoma all the way to Hollywood. He told Ron and me years later how it was supposed to work. He would camp out along the way, live off the land and by his wits, and finally arrive in Tinseltown on horseback, rugged and resplendent in his cowboy hat. The industry's grandees would be bowled over at the sight of a real singing cowboy and sign him up right quick. There was one big issue that kept him from pursuing this plan. Dad couldn't sing, could not carry a tune to save his life. This trait would not prove unique to him and our family. No one has ever mistaken the Howards for the Osmonds. Our group renditions of Happy Birthday were unlistenable to outsiders. Jean Spiegel was more polished, from a merchant family in the booming railroad town of Duncan, Oklahoma. She was considered by her peers to be one of the most gifted actors at OU and was nearly 2 years older than Harold. Dad had seen her in a campus production of Garson Kanin's Born Yesterday, in which she knocked him dead as Billy Dawn, a sleazy tycoon's floozy who blossoms into a strong, independent woman. Country boy Harold was intimidated by his scene partner's charisma and talent. He was also instantly besotted. Nobody likes to think of their parents as passionate young lovers. But from everything that Ron and I know, Cupid's arrow struck, and Harold and Jean quickly embarked upon a torrid romance. Dad was tall and lean, a rangy, good-looking young man who carried himself like a real-life cowboy. Mom was petite, not much over 5 feet in height, with a round porcelain doll face and wavy red hair. Their love was too big for the college town of Norman, Oklahoma, to contain. Not long after becoming a couple, Harold and Jean ditched school to chase the dream of becoming professional actors. After a period of struggle and penury, they booked a steady gig as members of a touring children's theater group, traveling from town to town in a repurposed school bus, playing venues as big as 400-seat theaters and as small as rinky-dink school auditoriums. Composed of around a dozen actors, the company included six adult little people who played the dwarves in Snow White and other fairy tale characters. Mom played ingenues and princesses, including the title role in Cinderella. Dad played the huntsman, the prince, and any other role that was required of him. When they needed an extra dwarf, he would kneel behind the scenery upstage, pacing back and forth on his knees to the point that they turned black and blue. He earned an additional $5 a week driving the prop truck, which followed behind the bus. This job granted him the extra benefit of scoring some alone time with Mom, who rode alongside him in the cab. Dad despised his name growing up. He hated the way Harold sounded and the nerdy image it projected. He would do imitations of people whining, "Harold, Harold." As for Beckenholt, it was a mouthful and an albatross. Dad lost too many hours of his precious childhood spelling it out for people. On top of that, this surname was way too German-sounding for an aspiring star of stage and screen in the post-World War II era. Sometime after he and Mom left school, Dad became Rance Howard. He never told us exactly where his new name came from, but our Aunt Glee, Dad's younger sister, says that he played a character named Rance in a play somewhere and liked how it sounded when his fellow actors addressed him by that name. And our surname? Shortly after Dad ran off with Mom, his folks, who had owned several farms over the course of his childhood, settled for good in Moline, Kansas, in Elk County, east of Wichita. Contiguous to Moline is the town of Howard. In fact, Howard, Kansas is where Dad's youngest sibling, his brother Max, still lives. Rance from a play plus Howard from Kansas equals Rance Howard. That's our best guess. Aunt Glee also says that our grandparents' feelings were bruised by Dad's name change. Granddad Beckenholt told Glee that he had spoken about the situation with a prosperous friend, a local car dealer, and the friend said that if it had been his son, he would have written the kid right out of his will. But Grandma understood Dad's reasoning and told anyone who asked that Harold had become Rance to better his odds in the show business.
I used to wonder why Dad didn't simply shorten his name to something like Hal Beck. As a kid, I sometimes wished my name was Ronnie Beck. It sounded cooler than Ronnie Howard. Dad was a quiet, low-key person. But Mom, when she met him, somehow saw in this innocent farm boy's eyes a fire to match her own. Jean Spiegel was a free-spirited child of the 1940s. Much of the war effort was powered by women on the home front, which proved liberating to girls like her. She had the brassy, bold spirit of Rosie the Riveter or the Andrews sisters executing the intricate harmonies and tight choreography of Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy. Mom was a natural leader at Duncan High School, even though she wasn't a good student. I've seen her old report cards, and they're terrible. Lots of D's. Still, she was voted president of her class. When I asked Mom how a D student managed to achieve this, she gave me a wry smile. "I got along with everybody," she said, eyes twinkling. I see a lot of her in my eldest daughter, Bryce. People are magnetically drawn to her, and she assumes the mantle of chief taskmaster organically. The University of Oklahoma was not Mom's first stop after she graduated from high school. She persuaded her parents to let her apply to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in New York, a storied acting school whose alumni included Lauren Bacall, Hume Cronin, Grace Kelly, and Kirk Douglas. Duncan to New York was not a common trajectory for a 17-year-old girl from the middle of the country, but Mom had drive and proved herself worthy. She aced her audition and moved east. For the few months that Mom studied at the academy, she thrived. She fell in love with New York City, the start of a lifelong affair. But early one morning, back in Duncan, her mother, our Grandma Louise, sat bolt upright in her bed and said to our grandfather, "Butch, something has happened to Jean." Whether this was a sign of her oracular powers or an indication that mothers are always in a panic about their teenage daughters, Louise was right. Mom had been hit by a truck while crossing the street, shattering her pelvis. She was in a coma for 10 days. Against all odds, Mom healed up, and she and her family received a sizable insurance settlement. But the accident put a temporary hold on her acting dreams. Mom came home to recuperate and attended a junior college for a year before finally attending OU. Jean Spiegel arrived at college hungry, keen to make up for lost time, yet also vulnerable. She was rusty from her time spent on the disabled list. Just as she electrified Dad with her charisma and very presence, so did the attentions of this handsome young Harold fella give her a much-needed boost. Meeting Dad rejuvenated Mom's acting ambitions and joie de vivre. She had found her partner in crime. Dad never knew what hit him. He soon discovered that Mom was a frisky, rambunctious girl who fell in love fast and hard. She revealed to him that she'd had two or three fiancés before they met. Mom used the term fiancé more loosely and impetuously than most people did. Still, these fiancés were more than just casual boyfriends. Dad actually met one of them, a fellow actor named Bill Curran, who paid them a visit at their first New York apartment on Manhattan's Upper West Side.
"We need to come clean about our parents here. The story they told us for most of our lives was that they first went to New York together after their wedding. Nope. In the 1990s, Dad finally fessed up that they had moved into an apartment with a bunch of other young actors before they got married. Yes, these two lovebirds were messing around. When they first ran off from college, they went to Nashville, where one of their friends had made it as an actor in that city's small theater scene. Mom and Dad struck out there. Their next stop was New York, Mom's happy place. The gig with the Traveling Children's Theater Troupe began there, administered by a Manhattan-based outfit called Penthouse Productions. One other thing. Before they set out on that tour, Dad found out that one of Mom's engagements was still semi-pending. While she was back home in Duncan after her accident, she fell for an Italian-American soldier stationed at Fort Sill in Lawton, Oklahoma, about 30 miles away. This fellow, whose last name was D'Angelo, was from the New York City area. The brash young Jean Spiegel, even as she was living in sin with Rance, called D'Angelo to let him know that she was in his neck of the woods. She accepted an invitation to dinner at D'Angelo's parents' home in the outer boroughs, a subway ride away. At dinner, she noticed that her old flame wasn't saying much. Finally, D'Angelo's little sister could keep her secret pin up no more. "He's engaged to marry another girl," she blurted out. The table went quiet until Mom calmly replied, "Well, we'll just have to have some more potatoes on that, won't we? Everyone laughed in relief and continued eating. But probably no one was more relieved than Dad when Mom came home and told him what had happened.
Dad later told me that part of his urgency in proposing to Mom when he was only 19 years old was that he wanted to get the other guys, or contenders, as he called them, out of the way. His proposal was accepted. This proved to be, fortunately for Clint and me, Mom's final engagement. As they toured with the children's theater troupe during the summer of 48, their desire to marry as quickly as possible grew ever more urgent. Dad revealed to me in my adulthood that he and Mom had no moral issue with living together unmarried, but society still frowned on couples who cohabitated without a wedding certificate. To my parents' frustration, they discovered that in most of the states that they visited, marriage required that both parties take a blood test and then endure a 3-day waiting period. That wouldn't work. The troop never stayed in any state for as long as 3 days. But as summer turned to fall, fortune smiled upon the young couple. At a diner in Ohio, a nosy but friendly waiter happened to hear Mom and Dad discussing their plight and butted in. Kentucky, the waiter said, had no such waiting period policy. Eagerly, Mom and Dad checked the schedule. Their next show was in the town of Winchester, Kentucky. Perfect. They could get hitched right away. And so, on the morning of October 5th, 1948, in the lobby of the Brown Proctor Hotel in Winchester, Gene Spiegel and Rance Howard were married. The officiant was a Methodist minister who they fortuitously met in the hotel the day before. The groomsmen were the troupe's 6 little person actors, who opened the ceremony by improvising a tap routine performed to the tune of Wagner's Wedding March, better known as Here Comes the Bride. Dad was 5 weeks shy of his 20th birthday. Mom was a comparatively mature and worldly 21. He wore a plaid suit. She wore one of her costume dresses, her Cinderella ball gown temporarily denuded of its theatrical sequins. The company put together a modest reception for them in the hotel lobby. The company manager, an older woman named Mrs. Lawton, improvised a wedding cake by having a local bakery stack 3 regular cakes and refrost them. Everyone danced to the jukebox in the lobby and drank through the afternoon and into the night. In Dad's telling, the groomsmen drank more and carried on later than anyone, undaunted by the call to be on the bus at 5 a.m. the following morning. The wedding was not entirely free of drama. Mrs. Lawton initially believed that Rance and Jean were being too rash. A couple of days before the ceremony, she asked my parents if Mom was pregnant and if that was the reason for the hurry. Even when Mom explained that she wasn't knocked up, Mrs. Lawton still tried to head off the ceremony, fearful that the young lovers were making a terrible mistake. Mom turned on her patented charm and brought the older woman around, to the point where Mrs. Lawton not only procured the cake, but also gave the bride away. When the news of their marriage reached the Spiegels in Oklahoma and the Buchenholz in Kansas, the reaction wasn't entirely rapturous. Granddad Buchenholz went to a lawyer to see if he could get the marriage annulled. The lawyer, citing the fact that Dad was of legal age, talked Granddad out of it. Dad was hurt but unsurprised by his father's actions. He anticipated that his parents would flip out over his sudden wedding, yet he was unwavering in his commitment to Mom and their shared pursuit of a life in show business. The Spiegels were caught by surprise, but not entirely shocked, given their daughter's romanticism and determined disposition. When the theater troupe rolled into Oklahoma, Granddad Butch and Grandma Louise magnanimously held an open house in Duncan that served as the new couple's proper reception. Dad was in black tie with a white dinner jacket. Mom was dressed in a beautiful off-the-shoulder gown with a billowing skirt of diaphanous white tulle. They looked fantastic. Granddad Buchenholz begged off from attending the Duncan reception, but Dad's mother, Grandma Ethel, made the drive to Oklahoma with her sister. This was a show of good faith and also a fact-finding mission to see, as my Aunt Glee put it, what kind of outfit Rance had married into. When the children's theater tour ended, my folks paid their first visit as a married couple to the Beckenholtz farm in Kansas, where they were received politely if stiffly. The Beckenholtz withheld their full approval of Mom for a long time. Not until Clinton and I came along did their wariness evaporate completely. With some savings from their theater work, my folks bought a used Willys Overland Jeepster softtop. After they were done visiting the Beckenholtz, Mom and Dad pulled away from the farm in Kansas, headed to the highway on-ramp, and paused for a moment to ponder which way to go. East or west? New York or Los Angeles? Mom didn't have to think for long. "East," she said. New York it was. Life in the big city was no cakewalk for the newlyweds. Mom quickly discovered that for all the joy that acting had brought her at school and on the road, the treadmill of auditioning in New York wasn't for her. She got some parts in some regional and off-off-Broadway productions, but the constant rejection inherent in a young actor's life was more than she could bear, as was the prospect of taking on work that would require her to be geographically apart from Dad. This issue came to a head when she was offered a role in a touring production of a play. My parents took a long walk along the Hudson River to discuss the matter. Dad encouraged Mom to accept the job, but she decided that she couldn't bear to part from her husband in this early stage of their marriage. When they got home from their walk, she called her agent and declined the role. This marked the end of her pursuit of an acting career. Beyond the odd role here and there in a regional production in which she and Dad could act together, Mom essentially retired from show business in her early 20s. At that point, she redoubled her efforts to help her husband succeed. If she wasn't going to act, by God, she would do her damnedest to earn enough money for both of them to live on while Dad went out on auditions. To that end, she took a job at Macy's, spritzing perfume samples on the wrists of lady customers, and another as a hat check girl at the Copacabana nightclub. For a while, even this wasn't enough. Dad wasn't landing any parts, so he too took on non-acting work. He loaded fresh fish and produce onto refrigerated trucks at the docks. He worked as an usher at a seedy grindhouse theater in Times Square, his job really more akin to a bouncer's. The theater was open all day and all night, playing the same double feature over and over again. Many indigent men more or less lived at the theater. There were constant fights, and it often fell to Dad and his fellow ushers to break them up, armed only with their flashlights. Dad was a pretty good fighter himself. He boxed competitively in his teens in Oklahoma. In New York, he started working out at a gym favored by pro fighters. His sparring sessions impressed the trainer there, so much so that the trainer offered to develop Dad as a light heavyweight. Needing the money, Dad announced to Mom his intent to train for his pro debut. Mom, horrified, extinguished that plan before it went any further. Fortunately, Dad soon got the break he had been waiting for, a call to audition for the touring company of Mr. Roberts. The show had been a hit on Broadway for more than 2 years. For part of the tour, Henry Fonda was going to step back into the title role which he had originated. Fonda was one of the biggest movie stars in the world, known for playing the title role in Young Abe Lincoln and Tom Joad in The Grapes of Wrath. He was also to become a significant figure in our lives, offering counsel both to Dad and to me as our paths crossed with his in the decades that followed. At his audition, Dad read for two theater legends, the producer, Leland Hayward, and the director, Joshua Logan, the team that brought Rodgers and Hammerstein's South Pacific to the stage. This was the big time. All the actors had to take off their shirts to prove that they were, quite literally, in shipshape condition. Dad easily passed that test. But he didn't win the co-lead part that he coveted of Ensign Pulver, the role that I would later act out as a precocious 3-year-old. Still, Logan took a liking to Dad and found a part for him as a crewman named Lindstrom. The pay was $100 a week for the run of the tour. Not Hollywood money, but a princely sum for a working actor, especially given that the tour was to last nearly a year. He and Mom were ecstatic. By this time, they were living on their own at last, with no roommates, in an apartment in Chelsea. They spent much of Dad's off hours from rehearsal sunning themselves on the building's roof to ensure that Dad would look convincingly like a sailor who has spent months in the South Pacific. When the Mr. Roberts tour began, they gave up their apartment, and Mom joined Dad on the road in such cities as Boston and Chicago, occasionally parting from him to visit her family in Oklahoma. My folks were happy and in love, and Dad believed he was on the cusp of making it in the business. When the tour arrived in Los Angeles, he took a meeting with Republic Pictures, a prolific producer of Westerns and B-movies, and the incubator of Roy Rogers and Gene Autry's careers, about possibly becoming a contract player, a prospect that excited him no end. But then fate intervened. The Korean War was on, and Uncle Sam wanted him. So much for his prospects, so much for Hollywood. At Mom's suggestion in 1951, Dad proactively enlisted in the Air Force to avoid conscription into the Army, where the odds were greater that he might find himself in combat. He excelled at basic training at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio. The military brass even offered him an opportunity to attend officer candidate school, but he had no aspirations to become an officer. He just wanted to put in his mandatory 4 years of service and be done with it. He requested to be assigned to Special Services, the entertainment branch of the U.S. military. Hank Fonda, Joshua Logan, and Leland Hayward wrote letters of recommendation to the sergeant in charge, attesting to Dad's suitability. That did the trick. As wartime assignments went, life in the Special Services was as good as it got. The assigning sergeant helpfully advised Dad to put in for off-base housing. This allowed him and Mom to find their own place and receive a living allowance, a small sum, but one that gave them the freedom to lead a semi-civilian life while Dad served. His job played to his strengths. He was in charge of staging shows on the base to keep his fellow airmen in good spirits. Better still, Dad would never see combat or travel overseas. Still, he was tremendously frustrated. He was finally getting somewhere in his acting career, and he would forevermore maintain that his 4 long years away from the business derailed whatever professional momentum he had built up. What's more, he was already a grown man, and he bristled at the enforced loss of individuality that the Air Force demanded. During basic training, he couldn't believe that he had to spend hours upon hours of his day marching in formation. His drill instructor barked out the commands, "Flight, forward, march! Flight, halt! Flight, bout face!" A flight was a group of 60 airmen. Dad viewed this period as a regression into an earlier part of his life. Legally, he was still Harold Beckenholt, and he winced at the sound of his birth name, especially when it was mangled by his commanding officers. One drill sergeant, who had a strong Boston accent and some kind of speech impediment, would shout, "Beckenbrook, keep the thumbs along the seam of your trousers." Dad looked at the man blankly, which only prompted a more furious recitation of the command. "God damn it! Diane, keep your thumbs along the seams of your trousers." It took Dad 3 weeks to figure out the sergeant was saying, "Try and keep your thumbs along the seams of your trousers." Dad had lots of other funny stories about the Air Force. He respected his peers and recognized the benefits that many of them reaped from this regimented way of life, but he never romanticized his military service. He considered it a duty, not a passion. That said, he was not totally bereft of passion in his Air Force years. A year into Dad's time in the service, he and Mom received the news that their first child was on the way.